Empathy never let her forget. And mere safety precautions were not enough to overcome the vertigo of a 2 kilometer drop. Her knuckles turned white as the drug left her. The apathy bracelet made its usual hissing noise, injecting filtration nanos into her bloodstream. In a few minutes, the first glimmers of empathy arose from the city. Mind noise rumbled from the residential towers north of the Diamond Palace, squat and ugly, densely populated. Each tower held over 100,000 of the capital's most numerous class, the petty bureaucrats who monitored taxable production claims. Every imperial administrator in the 80 worlds had a double here on home, another set of eyes following every transaction to ensure that the Senate and Emperor received their cut. Back on Vasthold, Nara had known of this army of distant and invisible overseers in the abstract, but 80 planets worth of them concentrated in this one city brought home the fantastic extent of the Empire. Huge data freighters left daily from the capital spaceport to resupply the possessions with entangled quanta. No expense spared to keep communications broadband and instantaneous, the Emperor's omniscience a matter of fact as well as scripture. As her empathy grew, Nara could feel the dynamics of slow shift changes, thousands of bureaucrats returning home as night fell over populous continents light years away, other thousands waking up to spread out across the low, windowless administration buildings as the day began in some megacity on another of the 80 worlds. War fever still animated the capital as a whole, but the minds of these countless minions never raised a cry above the rumble of drudgery, the cogs of the Empire. Nara wondered what the overseers for Legius were doing now that the planet had been cut off from the Imperial network. The whole world, except for a few military installations and the Lynx, had been intentionally made a dark spot since the compound mind had taken over. The Emperor had given up direct control of an entire planet simply to isolate the Rix abomination. What an insult to Imperial privilege. The lights of the capital all but obliterated stars from the night sky, and Nara felt her distance from Laurent, her helplessness. If the Lynx was destroyed too suddenly to manage a last transmission, it would be 8 hours before the lazy speed of the Constant brought the event to telescopes on Legius. Almost a day of not knowing. The War Council had voted hours ago. The battle must be engaged by now. Her lover might already be dead. Empathy gained another measure of intensity, and Senator Oxum could feel frantic thoughts down in the flame-dotted shape of the Martyrs Park. Ancestor-worshipping cults had erected effigies of Rix women down there, tall figures with hollow eyes, filled with fanciful artificial organs that gave off a plastic smell when they burned. The demonstrations of the faithful had grown every day since the murder of the Emperor's sister. Even Nara, a hardened secularist, could still feel the shock of that moment. The child Empress Anastasia was the reason, after all, a central character of childhood fables and rhymes. However much Nara Oxum hated the process that had cured Anastasia's long-ago disease, the child Empress and her brother had made the world Nara lived in. And no matter that she was 16 centuries old, Anastasia had still looked 12 on the day of her death. In any sane world, she would have died a long time ago, but it still felt utterly wrong that she had died at all. This late, most of the capital was asleep. The wild creature of the human group psyche was unusually quiescent, and Senator Oxum held on to sanity for long minutes. She tried to feel the Diamond Palace, but the cold minds of the apparatus undead and the disciplined thoughts of elite guardsmen provided little to grasp hold of. Why? She wondered softly, thinking of the Emperor's plan. The city was starting to swirl below her, the war animating even the capital's dreams. Nara imagined a nuclear airburst overhead, a sudden bright star blossoming in the sky. Instantly, the electromagnetic pulse would strike, and all the lights go out, the whole spectacle of the capital reduced to black silhouettes, lit only by the airburst and a few burning effigies in the park. Seconds later, however clean the warheads might be, a blast wave would rock her building, shattering windows, no doubt testing even the balcony's safeguards, and casting a rain of glass onto the streets below. That was the plan for distant Legius, if Laurent Zai failed. The nuclear attack might kill the Rix compound mind, but it would throw Legius into a dark age. After the falling air cars and failing medical endoframes, and all the disease, unrest, and simple starvation that accompanied a devastated infrastructure, there would be 100 million lives lost planet-wide, so the apparatus estimated. On a planet of 2 billion, that was not as bad as decimation in the old sense of 1 in 10. But still the old enemy, death, on a vast scale. She looked at the Diamond Palace again. What could be worth murdering 100 million people? The capital grew louder, becoming an angry chorus as her mind lost its defenses. In the sleepless free market towers to the south, she felt labor futures tightening nervously, titles and pardons being fought over like carrion, the anxious cycles of a war economy spinning ever faster. The mind noise turned to screeching, and again the old vision came. A great cloud of seagulls crowding the sky, wheeling around the bloated, dying thing that was the Empire. Nara Oxum felt she almost grasped something fatal and hidden in these moments of madness, when withdrawal from the drug left her empathy open to the assembled mass of the capital, the risen Empire in microcosm. Something was utterly rotten, she knew, a corruption tearing at the bonds that held the 80 worlds together. And she also knew that however hard she'd fought against the Emperor's rule, the shabby truth of how broken it all was would terrify her. A dark shape rose up before Oxum, blotting out the lights of the city. The senator tried to blink the apparition away, but its silent and winged form remained. She backed up a few steps, for a moment convinced that the empathic vision had somehow come to life and would consume her now. But a familiar sound tugged at her, second hearing, insistent through the howl of the city. She closed her eyes, and some sane fraction of her mind recognized it. The War Council summons. The fingers went to her bracelet, reflexively administering a dose of apathy. When she opened her eyes again, the shape was still there, an Imperial air car waiting patiently, its elegant wing extended to meet the balcony's edge. A missive hovered in second sight. The battle is joined. The Sovereign requests that his War Council attend him. Nara shook her head bitterly as the drug again suppressed her empathy, returning the capital to silence. She would not even be allowed to wait alone for news of Laurent and Legius. The Emperor and his war council, those who knew what was at stake, wanted company as they watched their miserable plan unfold. Nara Oxum crossed the wing to the waiting air car, not bothering to change. On Vasthold, one went plainly dressed and barefoot to funerals. In the next few hours, Laurent Zai would either save 100 million lives or die trying. Captain. Captain Laurent Zai exulted in the colors and sounds of the bridge. The battle was joined. Both ships had launched the bulk of their drone complements, and the outer reaches of the two multitudes were just now touching, just over half a light minute away, a pair of vast point clouds in stately collision. Automated drones were battling each other out there, the skirmishes of two fleets vying for advantage. The outcome of those first duels was still a mystery. Only the largest scout and remote fighter drones carried translite communications. Already, one side might have secured superiority in the outer skirmishes, and thus a crucial advantage in intelligence. The few scout drones with entangled communications could only tell the Lynx's crew so much about the enemy. If the Lynx's drones lost the battle at the edge, superior intelligence would be added to the Rix's already weighty advantages. This was one cost of Zai's hell-bent battle plan. If the first outlying duels were lost, there would be little time to recover. It would all be over quickly. "Anything from the master pilot?" Zai badgered Hobbs.
"He's still looking for an opening, sir."
Zai gritted his teeth and cursed. It would be foolish to second-guess Marx and order him in before he was ready. The master pilot was a brilliant tactician, and his remote fighters were far less numerous and more valuable than the automated drones currently battling on the outer edge of the fray. But Zai wished the man wasn't so damned fastidious. "Let me know when he deigns to join the battle." Zai tugged at his woolen uniform angrily. "And Hobbs, why is it so damned hot on my bridge?" Pilot. Master Pilot Joachim Marx watched the feints and penetrations of the battle with a boxer's patience, waiting for the proper moment to strike. Safe in the shielded center of the Lynx, Marx inhabited the viewpoint of the foremost entanglement-equipped drone among the frigate's complement. This drone was close to the fight, but not in it yet. The two opposing spheres of drone craft were just beginning to overlap, like some three-dimensional Venn diagram mapping the shallowest of intersections between sets. But with every passing second, the intersection increased by another 3,000 kilometers.
Within the broad front of the collision, drones darted, accelerating at thousands of Gs to effect the smallest of lateral changes. At the two fleets' huge relative velocity, drones could only shift themselves by hairlines relative to the enemy. They were like pistol-wielding duelists perched on the front of two approaching high-speed trains, hurtling toward each other, taking shuffling steps from side to side, trying to gain some slight advantage. From his vantage in the translite-equipped drone, Marx could see the outermost portions of the battle firsthand. He could command the drones around him to effect a swift parry. But the drones he sent these orders to were too small and cheap for entangled communications, so his orders reached them with the maddening tardiness of the constant. Marx was used to the millisecond delays of intelligences and other small craft, but these delays were like sending carrier pigeons to direct a battle kilometers away. The two waves of combatants continued their career into each other, and the flares of accelerating kinetic weapons began to light the void. The first wave of the Lynx's drones were spraying sand, huge clouds of tiny but sharp and corrosive carbon particles. Diamonds, the poets called them. At these relative velocities, sand could strip an armored drone like a desert storm tearing the skin from a naked man. The Rix craft responded with more sophisticated measures. Marx saw the shimmering flashes that were formations of Flocker missiles being launched. Each Flocker was no bigger than a human finger, but in phalanxes of 100 or more, they formed a hive entity of enormous versatility. They combined their resources to form a single sensor array, unified electronic defenses, and a hardy democratic intelligence. And like all Rix military hardware, Flockers evolved from battle to battle. In the first incursion decades before, they had been observed coordinating tactics across huge distances. They grouped themselves in larger or smaller formations as the situation dictated, and individuals sacrificed themselves to protect other Flockers of their group. Marx wondered how far they had progressed in the last 80 years. He had a feeling that the Lynx's crew was about to learn quite a bit on the subject. However smart these new Flockers were, though, the captain had made one point with which Marx had to agree. Cruder Imperial technology had an advantage at high velocities. Flockers and piloted drones used up a lot of their mass being clever, and cleverness didn't always pay off when a firefight took place in the blink of an eye. Sand was as dumb as a stone club, but its destructiveness increased with every kilometer per second. The master pilot's craft told him that the Flockers were hitting the first wavefront of sand. At relative rest, a dispersed cloud of sand was barely detectable. But plunging through it at 1% light speed transformed the cloud into a solid wall. Marx urged his drone closer. The view cleared quickly as he shot toward the battle's edge. His scout craft had an initial load of 2/3 reaction mass and could accelerate at 600 Gs at 25% efficiency. If he pointed it in one direction and pushed it, the drone would make just under a quarter of the constant in about 200 minutes, at which point it would be out of fuel. Although the drone lacked the elegance of Marx's beloved small craft, that one fact always amazed him. This machine, no bigger than a coffin, could make relativistic velocities. It had the power to push time. Even in this train wreck of a battle, the scout's acceleration could make a difference. Marx had taken it out in front of the Imperial drone fleet and then turned it over. Now he was falling back toward the Lynx, almost pacing the incoming Rix drones. He'd burned a sixth of his reaction mass, but Marx was where he wanted to be, in the rolling center of the conflict. He passed a few decelerating sandcaster drones, their cargoes emptied, they were pulling back. Marx waited, drumming his fingers. There should be fireworks by now. Where was the wave of explosions showing the disintegration of the first Flocker formations? Imperial sand posed little sensor interference. It was designed to be invisible. But no explosion showed in Marx's view, just acceleration and launch flares. Were the Flockers dying quietly, whittled down to nothing by the terrific friction of the sand? Marx pushed in closer, seeking answers at the risk of his scout. A firefight had started between the larger advanced drones, who'd launched all their satellites and were now attacking each other directly. Rick's beam weapons lit the void, igniting ambient sand like searchlights on a misty night. But Marx could see nothing that looked like a host of small craft disintegrating. He cut his craft's acceleration, trying to stay out of the fight. Then Marx saw the column. It glinted just for a moment in a radar reflection, 4 kilometers long. For a moment, he thought it was a single structure. Then the AI calculated its exact diameter, and he realized what it was. a single column of flockers, probably all that the battlecruiser had launched. More than 5,000 of them, spaced less than a meter apart. His senses told of the formation's incredible exactness. The whole 4 kilometers had the diameter of Marx's thumb. He could see minute flashes from the front of the column now. Every few seconds, the lead drone was being destroyed by sand. Then the next one took its place and lasted a few more seconds. But behind these sacrifices, the vast majority of the flockers were protected. They were like army ants crossing a river, the latter arrivals marching on the backs of the foremost after they had drowned. They were punching a very narrow hole into the wall of sand and slipping through. Marx had seen flockers spread themselves into a far-flung bestiary of shapes, radiating arms like paper fans or the struts of a parasol, toroids and lazy eights that undulated with a standing wave, point clouds buzzing with internal motion. But never had he seen anything so deviously simple. A straight line. And they were getting through. Another image occurred to Marx. On his home planet lived a species of rat that could break down its own bones, funneling itself into a thin sack of jelly to climb through even the narrowest of cracks. He shuddered at the thought. Marx's surprise cost him a vital moment of attention. He didn't immediately notice the 10 flockers that burst from the line, having detected a transient gap in the sand between his scout craft and the column. By the time the master pilot reacted, the flockers were lined up on him at 3,000 Gs. Although they had less than a second of reaction mass at that acceleration, Marx's twisting, evasive pattern came too late, his larger drone twisting like some slow-footed mastodon brought down by a pack of small predators. Synesthesia filled with lightning, sputtered for a moment, then dumped him into the calming cerulean wash of a dead signal. He cursed and cursed again. Gathering himself, Joachim Marx signaled XO Hobbs. "I saw," Hobbs said. She'd been watching over his shoulder. He bit his tongue as a wave of shame struck him. In a Class 7 translite drone on a scouting mission, and he'd been beaten by a handful of pilotless drones. "They're getting through the sand," he shouted. "The Lynx is..." "We'll be briefing the captain in 40 seconds, Hobbs interrupted. "I want you on the bridge in virtual."
40 seconds? An eternity in this battle, a dozen opportunities lost to delay.
"And what should I do for 40 seconds, Executive Officer?"
A dead pause. His audio muted as Hobbs attended to one of the other dozen conversations she was no doubt juggling. Then she was back.
"I suggest you reflect thankfully upon the fact that you fly remotes, Master Pilot. See you in 30 seconds.
Her voice left him alone in his blue, dead universe. As he waited, Marx's fingers twitched, aching to fly again.
"Captain. In short, the flockers are getting through the sand," Hobbs concluded.
Laurent Zai nodded.
"They always do. What's the projected attrition?"
Hobbs swallowed. These nervous tics were unlike her, Zai thought. She had lost some confidence since the mutiny.
"Perhaps a tenth, sir. The other 90% are coming through."
10%?
Zai glared down into the bridge main airscreen, where the long, thin needle of flockers hovered. Normally, the small and expendable drones were reduced to a small fraction of their initial numbers. He and Hobbs had expected the sand to be especially deadly at this speed, but instead, it had proved useless. There were almost 5,000 flockers in the first wave alone, more than enough to tear the Lynx to pieces, and they would arrive in some 16 minutes.
"Did they use this single-column tactic in the last war?" he asked. "No, sir. Perhaps a new evolutionary..."
Hobbs began.
"Begging your pardon, Captain,"
interrupted the disembodied head and shoulders of Master Pilot Marx. His image floated in the captain's private airscreen, projected from a flight canopy in the Lynx's core.
"Yes, Master Pilot. In a normal battle, forming into a single column wouldn't give flockers any advantage. Sand is ejected outward from hundreds of small delivery canisters, so any given sandstorm contains hundreds of different trajectories. The relative motion between sand and flockers is chaotic."
"So a column would offer no protection," Hobbs said.
"Correct."
Marx's fingers came into view, gesturing through calculations.
"But in this battle, our 2 drone fleets are moving through each other at 3,000 clicks per second. The lateral chaotic motion of the sand is erased by its relative insignificance to the overall motion.
The flock of column punches through even the biggest sand cloud in a few thousandths of a second. Zai closed his eyes. He'd been foolish not to see it. Perhaps not this specific tactic, but the basic flaw in his plan. The Lynx's high speed of attack flattened events. A quote from Anonymous 167 came to him too late. "Against a simple tactic, a simple response is often effective," he muttered. The Ricks had found that simple response.
"Pardon me, sir,"
Marx said. Hobbs nodded vigorously, translating the aphorism for Marx. "The high relative velocity between our two ships channels relationships into a single dimension, that of the approach axis. In effect, we've made this a single variable battle."
"And the Ricks have countered with a one-dimensional formation," Captain Zai concluded. "A line."
"The Flockers will reach us in 14 minutes, sir," the watch officer interjected. Zai nodded calmly, but inside he seethed. The Lynx's rate of acceleration was pitiful compared to that of the tiny Flockers. There was no way to maneuver out of this. They were defenseless. He clenched his real hand. To have chosen life, to have thrown away honor, only to be extinguished by an idiotic mistake. Zai had broken his oath to see Nara again, but it looked as if his betrayal would come to nothing. Perhaps this was natural law in action. On Vader, they said that a knife found its way easily to the heart of a traitor. He looked again at the airscreen representation of the Flocker attack. The column was not exactly a knife. It was too long and thin, like some primitive projectile weapon. An arrow, or maybe... An old memory surfaced.
"This has become something of a joust," Zai said.
"A joust, sir?"
"A pre-diaspora military situation. More of a ritual, really. In a joust attack, a very long kinetic contact weapon was propelled toward the enemy by animal power."
"Sounds unpleasant, sir," Hobbs said.
"Rather."
Zai allowed his mind to drift back in time. He saw the constructs battling in his grandfather's great pasture on Vader. The horses were spectacularly rendered, their flanks gathering loam as the hot afternoon went on. The brightly festooned knights rode toward each other. Their steeds' hooves drummed the ground with a rhythmic shudder that rattled the nerves like the overflight of an armored rotary wing. The long sticks, lances, they were called, striking against...
"Hobbs," Zai said, seeing an answer. "Are you familiar with the origin of the word shield?"
Hobbs's utopian upbringing had provided her only patchy knowledge of ancient weapons.
"I'm afraid not, sir."
"A straightforward device, Hobbs. A two-dimensional surface used to ward off one-dimensional attacks."
"Useful, sir."
So I could see Hobbs's mind struggle to follow him.
"Captain," Marx interrupted. "The first formation of Flockers will reach the Lynx practically at full strength. More than 4,000 of them. Our close-in defenses can't cope with so many at once."
"A shield, Hobbs. Prepare to fire all four photon cannon." Marx began to protest, and Zai cut the man's sound off with a gesture. Of course, as the master pilot had been about to complain, capital weapons like the Lynx's photon cannon were useless against Flockers. It would be like hunting insects with artillery.
"What's the target, sir?" Hobbs asked.
"The Lynx," he said.
"We're firing at..."
she began. Then, even as her fingers moved to alert the gunners, understanding filled her face.
"I assume we can target the heat sink manifold directly, sir."
"Of course, Hobbs. No need to test the energy shunts."
"We'll be ready to detach the manifold on your order, Captain."
"Exactly, Hobbs." He turned his attention to the flailing, voiceless master pilot.
"Marx, get back into the foremost scout,"
Zai commanded, then gave the man back his voice.
"And my orders, sir?"
"Attack the Rick's receiver array, with a sandcaster if you can find any alive." The master pilot thought silently for a moment. Then he said,
"Perhaps if there were an unexploded canister."
"Do it," Zai commanded, and erased the man's image from the bridge.
"All cannon ready, sir, targeting our own heat sink array at 20% power."
Zai paused, wondering if there were yet another factor he hadn't considered. Perhaps he was making another idiotic mistake. He wondered if any Imperial shipmaster had opened fire on his own ship before, without self-destruction in mind. But the war sage's words reassured him.
"If you fail, fail dramatically.
At least you will prove the error of your tactics to your successors. Zai nodded. This diversion would get into the textbooks one way or another.
Fire!
Pilot. Banished from the bridge, Mark leaped back into the forefront of battle. He chose another scout craft, displacing a sensor officer who was flying it at one remove. She'd been running three scouts at once, coordinating their efforts through a high-level interface. The master pilot kicked her off, settled in, and flexed the machine's muscles. He informed all Imperial drones within 10,000 clicks that he was assuming control of them. Marx accelerated his impromptu battle group into a cone-shaped collision formation focused upon the Rix battlecruiser. He brought the scout's fusion drive, which doubled as its primary offensive weapon, out of stealth mode. He would need some serious power. These actions were all likely to draw the attention of the Rix. The scout was blaring across a wide range of EM, making itself known to the enemy's battle management intelligences, human and machine. They would spot the valuable asset quickly, a drone under human command and at front center of the Lynx's satellite cloud, the position most threatening to the enemy battlecruiser. Within seconds, Mark saw distant acceleration traces deep in the Rix cloud, the plumes of hunters vectoring toward his new vessel. In all likelihood, the master pilot would be losing his second scout of the day inside a minute. But his fingers moved confidently, drawing an ever-expanding sphere of resources into the attack. Marx didn't expect to live long anyway. The nearly full-strength Flocker squadron was approaching the Lynx too fast. Pilots were nestled in the armored belly of Imperial warships, in the hope that the drones of a dying ship would fight on under human control, damaging the enemy even as their own vessel was destroyed around them. But at this high relative velocity, the Flockers would plunge through the Lynx like barrage rockets through a cloud of steam. There would be no safety even in the pilots' armored canopies. Death, real, absolute, non-virtual death, was headed toward Joachim Marx at 3 million meters per second. So he flew with uncharacteristic aggression. Perhaps he could shed some Rix blood on his way out. Between his drone and the enemy battlecruiser, the master pilot spotted the distinctive shape of a Rix gravity array. The array was a simple defensive weapon. At its core was a free-floating, easy-gravity generator, the same device that created artificial gravity in starships, equipped with limited AI and its own reaction drive. Surrounding the generator was a host of gravity repeaters. These small devices were held in place by the easy gravity, but also shaped and controlled it. An array could create a gravity well, or hill, in any configuration, strong enough to halt or deflect enemy drones and kinetic weapons. As he closed, Marx could see more of them, forming a huge barrier before the battlecruiser, perfect protection for the receiver. The gravity array closest to Marx was spread wide, giving readings of only 60 Gs, just strong enough to corral the clouds of sand still crashing through the Rix fleet. It was the Rix device closest to Marx, and he decided to destroy it. He ordered a nearby Ramscutter drone to launch its full complement at the gravity array. The craft spun like a firework wheel, spitting hordes of tiny, stupid flechettes from its flanks, exhausting itself in seconds. As per its programming, the Ramscutter drone started to pull back toward the Lynx for reloading, but Marx urged it forward. Perhaps he could use the expended drone as a ram. In any case, there would soon be no mothership to return home to. Marx wondered if the captain really had any plan for defending his ship against the Flockers. Zai had spoken as if he'd seen a way to escape destruction, but the captain's words had been cryptic, as usual. It was probably just an act, the necessary false confidence of command. Some morale-related edict from that long-dead sage that Zai and Hobbs were always quoting. Well, just as long as they kept the Lynx together for a few more minutes, long enough for Marx to hit the Rix battlecruiser. Marx knew he was the best pilot in the Navy. Dying without putting a scratch on the enemy prime would be an unacceptable end to his career. The flechette slammed into the array, whipping through the hills and troughs of its gravity contours like a flight of arrows suddenly caught in a wind tunnel. Marx let them spread through the array for a few seconds, then ordered all but a dozen to self-destruct. The invisible contours of the array filled with clouds of shrapnel. The bright reflections of broken metal spread through the warped space like milk dispersing in swirling coffee. The churning shrapnel ate through the gravity repeaters, and the array's gravity shape flopped about, then flattened into a simple sphere, a steep, defensive hill of almost 1,000 Gs. Marx took command of the few flechettes he had left and targeted the sphere's center, the gravity generator itself.
The remaining flechettes bolted toward it from all directions. Normally, the tiny machines moved invisibly fast, but they climbed the steep gravity hill with eerie slowness. Mark